and welcoming everyone to tonight's Core Volunteer Training lesson. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and Core Volunteer Training is specifically created to support you in becoming more active and empowering you in achieving your larger goals for climate advocacy. And tonight's learning goals are really threefold. We want to make sure that after attending the lesson, every attendee understands a bit more about the rationale for the three legs behind CCL's flagship policy, carbon fee and dividend, can really help describe each of these legs, if you will, in your own words and how it would really function and interact for a country. And then really also address economic issues related to each leg that are often raised by others with questions that you might have tonight or that you want to pose in our robust Q&A section. It's my esteemed pleasure to introduce Robert Archer, an economist by training with a BA from Yale and a master's from the University of Pittsburgh. Bob is a former Peace Corps volunteer and worked on energy reform, regulatory development, and energy efficiency in Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union, South and Southeast Asia, all with USAID, the Agency for International Development. And he comes up to us tonight with over 30 years of experience working on economic policy for national and Washington, D.C. based interests. He now spends his time generously volunteering for CCL and serves on the steering committee of the Marin, California CCL chapter and is part of CCL's economic policy network as well. So we've got a wonderful speaker lined up for you. So without further ado, the agenda is pretty straightforward. We're going to start with an introduction that we're almost done with. We'll have three sections on the three legs, the fee, the dividend, and carbon border adjustment. And then we'll have a chance to do Q&A, and should we run out of questions, rather, we'll have time for a partner activity, even as most core volunteer trainings pair people up. Without further ado, I'll pass it to you, Bob. Thank you all for being on tonight's webinar. And we look forward to jumping right in. The floor is yours, Bob.
Thank you, Brett, and good evening. I want to start with this slide, what are people's concerns and perceptions, in order to give some context as we discuss the CCL policy. It is useful to consider the framework people have when they think about a carbon tax. A synthesis, 39 studies was done by two Swiss and English research institutes to identify how to make carbon taxes more acceptable. It showed four main concerns. First, the personal costs are too high. Second, the negative income on low-income households. Third, people's mistrust about governments, that they think that they want the revenues and not emissions reductions. And fourth, an important one, is they don't think that a carbon tax is effective in discouraging high carbon behavior. The beauty of our policy is that the first three are addressed directly by the equitable design of the carbon fee and dividend. The last big obstacle, number four, is a perception that this presentation will address. The study indicated that the failure to understand the carbon fee impact on emissions leads people to want to designate or earmark the carbon fee revenues for clean energy expenditures instead of the carbon dividend. The good news is that these two preferences are reversed when people understand the fee does reduce emissions. The household dividend then becomes the preference. So we in CCL need to make it clear that the carbon fee does reduce emissions. So why a carbon fee? Two very significant reasons. One, in order to raise the fossil fuel costs, and second, to correct a market failure. So when you raise the price of fossil fuels, demand goes down and emissions go down. This connection is not sufficiently understood or accepted. Now, the second reason is to correct a market failure. When a factory dumps its pollution, such as CO2, in the air and water, the cost falls on us, not them. It's called a negative external cost. So there's no incentive for the polluter to change. Here's where the polluter pays principle applies. CCL's carbon fee puts the cost back on the cause of the pollution, fossil fuels. Now, any carbon policy won't do. The great power of CCL's escalating fee is the predictable rising price. It sends a powerful signal, an incentive for large-scale clean energy investment and innovation, unlike, for example, cap and trade, which has not provided the trajectory or predictability or environmental certainty as academic theory contends. There are other very good reasons for a carbon fee. And look at this in the context of a carbon fee versus cap and trade, which is often a policy consideration. Simplicity, transparency, efficiency all lead toward a carbon fee. Effectiveness, administrative ease, and I want to emphasize this last one, that a carbon fee and dividend are the best fit for developing countries with weak institutions and corruption compared to cap and trade with its opacity, complexity, and administrative discretion. So why call it a fee? Whenever we talk about placing a fee on carbon, the question often comes up, isn't a fee the same as a tax? Well, a fee is an appropriate term. It's commonly used for environmental programs that assign costs to pollution activities. For example, if you dump your garbage in the street, a fee will be imposed for pickup. Maybe the best reason came from George Shultz, who was Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State and also served as Treasury Secretary. Shultz, who's a CCL advisory board member, has told CCL, it's not a tax if the government doesn't keep the money. And that's the point. The fee's not a fundraiser for more government programs. It's used as a price signal to shape the billions of investment and consumption decisions toward clean energy and efficiency. Now, the fee starts at $15 a ton, and you can see that it rises $10 a year whenever we would achieve our targets by 2050. Most other proposals start higher and escalate slower. Now, a fee of $25 or $50 a ton could generate from $1.25 trillion to $2.5 trillion over a decade. It is very large in terms of revenue production. So why would you start low and escalate like that? It avoids economic shock and early political backlash that could occur in this kind of situation. It allows economic adjustment by industry, utilities, and households. And it provides a clear long-term signal rising to get the largest behavior response, which is called tax salience. How is the fee administered is a very common question, and it's basically using existing IRS and Treasury Department procedures and avoids the creation of a new bureaucracy. And where will it be applied? The fees applied upstream is the common term, that is, as close as possible to the mine, the well, and the point of importation. For example, for coal, the fee could be imposed at the mine or approximately the 500 coal preparation plants. There's actually an IRS excise tax form 720 where a single line could be added. For oil, the fee can be placed at the approximately 140 refineries, and for natural gas at the 500 some processing plants. So it's manageable. Now, there are two misunderstandings I want to address about the fee. The first is many hold the view that industry will pass on all the carbon fee to consumers and continue their business as usual polluting. It's not the case. fact, the carbon fee affects all industry, businesses, governments, utilities, and consumers. Billions of investment and consumption decisions are made and affected each day by the fee. Most industries have to absorb some of the rising costs. A recent study showed that selected industries react to rising energy costs in different ways. 25 to 75% of the energy cost increases are passed on to consumers, depending upon the industry's competitive position, their market power, and the availability of consumer alternatives. In addition, industry also shifts some of those costs and burden back up to the fossil fuel suppliers by substitution of clean energy options they may have and greater efficiency. The second myth is that the fee won't reduce emissions. This myth too holds that the fee doesn't work through the economy and reduce emissions, and therefore this incorrect understanding leads people to think that their revenues then must be spent on clean energy subsidies and programs to reduce emissions. There, as I just mentioned, you see that rising energy costs affect all sectors, investments, and consumption decisions, how their behavior changes. The price signals nudge all towards greater efficiency and a search for cheaper and cleaner energy alternatives. Now, moving on to the second leg, why a household dividend? Everyone has a view on the use of the massive revenues. So why do we lean towards revenue neutrality in a household dividend? It is equitable, and it protects low to middle income households. People like it and lobby for the continued fee, and it pumps money into the economy at the consumer level. It's important to note that the dividend would not be part of social programs' eligibility determination. People will not get hurt. Low-income households will not be adversely impacted through the dividend being considered means-tested income. Probably aware that the household dividend consists of a full share for up to two adults, half shares for up to two children up to age 18. And while taxable, the dividend should not be counted in eligibility for the social programs like the earned income tax credit. A family of four in the first year would get close to $800 in the dividend. In year five, it would be around $2,000. In year 10, approaching $3,500. Here's an example of three fictional households. Just circumstances of different kinds of households and how they would come out ahead with a dividend compared to rising energy costs. The politics of dividends are very equal to the issues related to a fee being imposed. Long-term sustainability of any climate policy is critical, and the dividend makes every household a long-term, broad-based constituency for maintaining a carbon fee and dividend policy. This characteristic of our policy is not adequately addressed, understood, or appreciated by a lot of people. The Alaska Permanent Fund, which is 43 years old, shows the staying power of the dividend concept. Alaskans have fought to keep their annual dividend in place. Many conservatives and progressives, of course, have different interests for the revenues, preferring, for example, offsetting tax cuts by conservatives and spending on clean energy by progressives. Now, here's a chart that shows how it would be administered. Filing for non-filers of income tax forms, a new form would be created, fairly simple, that would provide the information needed to calculate and make the dividend payment. This has been spelled out in a study that CCL sponsored. Now, the economic impact of the fee and dividend is a topic of considerable interest and a lot of modeling activity. And CCL keeps up on these many studies and what the economic impact we can expect from the fee and dividend. It depends significantly on how the revenues are used. The impact on economic growth overall is probably around break even, ever so slightly positive or negative, depending upon the modeling and the assumptions. For certain, the economy grows. How much is the question? The REMI study shows results on employment, GNP, and income that are slightly positive over 20 years. The study includes health benefits also. And U.S. service industries, such as retail and healthcare, et cetera, are shown to benefit. Many economic impact models have been run comparing our policy, the revenue neutral dividend, with tax cuts. Now, a note of warning is required here. Economic models focus narrowly on economic efficiency. They don't capture climate benefits, local pollution reduction benefits, the accelerated innovation that would be expected to occur, etc. While some models like REMI have shown a positive economic impact, others find a slight drag on economic growth. The emerging consensus is that offsetting the revenue with corporate or payroll taxes may benefit economic growth slightly more than a carbon dividend, but the difference would be quite small. What is clear is the CCL dividend is far more equitable than a tax swap policy or using the revenues for clean energy expenditures. What's the impact on municipalities? A topic that comes up fairly often. All households receive dividends. That means the increased spending benefits retail businesses and municipal tax revenues. On the cost side, municipal buildings and transportation are going to have higher energy costs. So the incentive grows for municipalities to endorse and embrace conservation, efficiency, and substitution even more than they are today. There's a wealth of municipal experience and programs to deal with increasing energy costs, including a significant private sector role. The dividend is most equitable use of the revenues. Treasury Department analysis showed that the bottom 70% of households generally break even or come out ahead. Their dividend equals or exceeds the increased cost of energy and products. It's progressive. It disproportionately benefits lower income households. What about the other ways of using revenues that I mentioned? Payroll tax cuts would be somewhat progressive, mostly for the middle class. Personal tax cuts would depend who gets them. Corporate tax cuts would be regressive, lower income households not benefiting. But it's important to mention that the government clean energy programs have not shown the progressiveness. The bottom 60% receive only 10% of the tax credits. I'm talking about solar credits, energy efficiency programs, automobile, electric vehicle programs. Now, with regard to the regulations, CCL takes no position on the role of regulation, whether to expand, modify, or reduce. It's important to note the impact, as I said, is not very positive. And in some more detail, the bottom 60% received only 10% of the clean energy tax credits during 2006 to 2012. And the upper 20% received 60% of the credits. And the most regressive tax was for the electric vehicles, where the upper 20% got 90% of the subsidies. Some experts suggest the following guideline regarding the role of regulation. Where a carbon fee does not impact a sector's emissions sufficiently, such as rental housing, then complementary regulation would be justified, such as housing codes and efficiency programs. Household energy costs will rise 5 to 10% with the initial $15 per ton fee. This will stimulate awareness and initiation of changed behavior without economic shock and political backlash. The average U.S. home energy bill is about $2,060 a year. That's for your heating, cooling, lighting, etc. So a 10% increase is about $200 a year. And if you recall, I said that the first year dividend will be approximately $700 for a family of four. Very important, what is the fee impact on emissions? It's significant, and it varies based on the tax rate, the trajectory, and economic growth. The REMI study showed over 50% decline in 20 years, as well as health co-benefits. Other models show potential reductions of 25 to 47% by just 2030, which exceeds the Paris and clean power plans. Let's look at two real-world carbon tax programs. And I noted someone is listening in here from Seattle, so you'll probably hear discussion about British Columbia. The British Columbia Revenue Neutral Carbon Tax is an outstanding program. It did reduce emissions. It was revenue neutral, mostly through reducing corporate and personal tax cuts with a few smaller payments for rural households. The polling support rose from below 50% to over 60% over the 5 years that it was rising. And it served as a model for the nationwide Canadian revenue neutral carbon tax, which is coming into place this year. However, a key lesson learned is that the tax swap approach to revenue neutrality can break down. Part of the 2008 revenue neutral efficient tax swaps were steered in 2013 to the favored film industry, and revenue neutrality was recently dropped by the center-left and Green parties following the recent elections. And a most outstanding and dramatic example is in the United Kingdom. A carbon tax, what they call a carbon price floor, on coal and gas for power generation caused a 90% decline in coal use for electricity generation from 2014 to 2017. Renewables and gas generation increased. The UK imposed it on top of the European Union cap and trade program, which was struggling along at $5 to $10 a ton for 5 years and recently spiked. That's the second leg. Let's move on to the third leg, the border carbon adjustment. This is probably a must-have feature in order to succeed on a global basis. So why a border carbon adjustment? It's critical to avoid adverse economic impacts due to unfair trade that could result from a carbon fee without border adjustment. It removes any incentive for U.S. industries to move to countries without a comparable carbon price. It avoids exporting pollution. Countries will tend to avoid imposing their own carbon price and let others carry the burden. They're known as free riders. Research on economic trade shows that idealistic ambition will not be sufficient to get countries to adopt significant country climate programs. Economic and industry impacts are high on the list of congressional questions and concerns. What about China? Is a common inquiry in our congressional meetings. Now, what is the border carbon adjustment? It's a tariff placed on goods imported from and a rebate on goods exported to countries without an equivalent price in carbon. It's based upon the carbon content of the goods in question. The terms duties, tariffs, and levies are often used interchangeably. So you have two parts on this, a tariff or levy on goods imported from countries without that price, and a rebate on U.S. exports to countries without an equivalent price. Now, here's some examples of current duties. Usually many of them are very low, some are a little bit higher, and many of them don't even have tariffs. So it's a topic of interest today in the U.S. tariff discussions. So which industries are likely to be at risk? It's pretty common sense. Those that use a lot of energy and are facing international competition. There's a term for trade, for industries like this. By a lot of energy use, that means 5% or more of their production costs. And if they're exposed to trade competition, that means 15% of their product is traded. The term is EITE, Energy Intensive Trade Exposed. Not a very useful term. There's an example of real-world impact of a rising carbon tax and no border adjustment in the case of British Columbia. Their greenhouses, where they grow flowers and vegetables, they suffered competitively at $24 a ton in 2012 and were exempted. Californian and Mexican greenhouses undercut them because they had no similar carbon price. That's only about which industries? It's about 44 out of 500. They're the obvious ones, metals, cement, chemicals, fertilizers. And it would increase their cost about 5 to 20% depending upon the industry. So once again, why is this important? It adds cost to U.S. firms' products. U.S. firms would lose market share in the U.S. and overseas as well. And if they moved overseas, you're going to have what's called leakage, carbon leakage. They would just produce the CO2 overseas. Who administers and collects this fee? The existing institutions administer the process, the Department of Commerce, International Trade Administration, U.S. Customs and Border Protection. These funds are collected and separate from the carbon fee and dividend, and they would build up over time. Are there any legal obstacles? Probably not. The World Trade Organization and GATT have a couple of articles in there that a carbon fee could fit. If it, for some reason it did not, there is what's called a, that's the Articles 2 and 3, and then Article 20 is a general exception article. What allows for environmental tariffs and trade. How does it create the domino effect? Firms in other countries have to pay the U.S. border adjustment. That's the stick. But in countries are incentivized to establish their own carbon price so the firms can avoid paying the U.S. border adjustment levy. And that's the carrot. Why global pricing? Step back and think about this, and it is that climate change is global. It requires a solution that first addresses the free rider problem of countries that don't want to go along. It incentivizes, second, that something that incentivizes all countries to participate. And third, is a good fit for developing countries with weak institutions, corruption, and income inequality. A carbon fee meets these requirements. Note that subnational initiatives by states or regions are important, but only a national approach can impose border carbon adjustments, which encourage carbon price harmonization around the world. There's a path to global carbon pricing. Bilateral and multilateral agreements among a subset of nations with a border carbon adjustment and open to others may be the most pragmatic and promising. For example, the U.S., Canada, Europe, and India and China could start and others could join in that whole process. So wrapping up the fee, dividend, and the border carbon adjustment, the fee works. fuel prices go up, demand and emissions go down. Steady rising price affects all sectors in innovation. Economic impact will be essentially neutral. On the revenue, the dividend is most equitable. It builds constituency support, and it's progressive, unlike the alternatives. Border carbon adjustment would address the unfair foreign competition. Free rider countries have the incentive to adopt, and it would incentivize global carbon pricing.
Excellent. What a whirlwind tour you've taken us on, Bob, here. Let's just give a big round of applause first and foremost for a half hour that covers a lot of ground. And I know that a couple of those slides we sped through very quickly. So I have linked the slides. I see a lot of people are following along with us. But if you have questions based on tonight, feel free to follow along the slide deck and also email us. And just as a question for how to get a hold of us, Bob has generously made himself available. So if anyone does have questions or would like to speak to either myself or Bob after tonight, thank you for stepping in tonight. And on behalf of everyone that is still on the line, if there's any questions that you have or comments about tonight's webinar, please feel free to reach out. We'd love your feedback. We'd love to go further. If this didn't address what you were looking for, let us know how we can be a resource. And thanks again for being on the line tonight, everyone. You guys are making the critical difference out there.